girls going on top of the cars, burning their veil, making bonfires with their mandatory hijab. For me, as a literary scholar, that is just a metaphor of the dead corpse of a rotted ideology that is no longer functional. I kissed you by the side of the road, stealthily, out of the officers, the night watcher's sight, stealthily. We were lost in one another's bodies and eyes, our hands twined together and trembling, stealthily. Our love dripped wine on the alley's body, on religion's scruples, on faith and belief, stealthily. The black veil of night and far off days, the thrills in schools in secret, stealthily. Every day, always with two faces, fleeing from death patrols, stealthily, longing to be free of unwelcome condemnation. How I wish it could come to an end, stealthily.
Since the death of Mahsa Amini in police custody on the 16th of September 2022, Iran has been rocked by protests spearheaded by young Iranian women and known worldwide by the catch cry, Women, Life, Freedom. Protest movements seeking systemic change in authoritarian states are often hampered by the state's efforts to control the boundaries of acceptable versus unacceptable forms of activism, or to repress movements altogether. Nonetheless, protesters challenge these boundaries in a myriad of creative ways. Today, we will be taking a look at the intersection of poetry and protest in Iran's women-led uprisings to better understand both the challenges and the revolutionary opportunities of women's activism in authoritarian states. From the University of Cambridge and the Center of Governance and Human Rights, my name is Nima Jayasingha, and I am your host for this episode of Declarations. I also have with me in the studio Claire Francis, who's a student in MPhil in Politics and International Studies, as a panelist today, who will help lead this discussion. Claire, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Nima.
As our special guest today, we have Dr. Fatima Shams. Thank you so much, Dr. Fatima, for being here with us today. It is an honor to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Fatima Shams is an Iranian activist, award-winning poet, and expert on modern Iranian history and Persian literature. She is the author of A Revolution in Rhyme, Poetic Co-option Under the Islamic Republic, which she explores the state's use of poetry as a tool of political legitimacy in post-revolutionary Iran. She has also published three highly regarded collections of contemporary bilingual poetry, including, most recently, the collection When They Broke Down the Door. She is currently an assistant professor of modern Persian literature at the University of Pennsylvania. Following her involvement in the 2009 Green Movement, Dr. Shams has lived in exile, and she is at the forefront of diaspora activism in supporting ongoing women-led uprisings in Iran. She is part of a feminist collective which recently published the Iran Women's Bill of Rights, calling for inclusive and substantive equality for women to be enshrined in the Iranian constitution. With that introduction, I will be handing it over to Claire, who will be interviewing our guest today. Over to you, Claire.
Thank you, Nima. Iran has a long history of popular protest which predates the Islamic Republic. Could you tell us a little bit about the historical continuities between the current uprising, the 2009 Green Movement, and pre-revolutionary women's movements in Iran? Should we understand the current uprising as part of this history, or is it something entirely different?
Thank you, Claire. It's certainly part of a much longer history of revolt and protest in modern Iran. And also, a quite unique moment, I would say, in the history of modern Iran as well. So in terms of the continuity, I think we need to understand this moment as part of what really happened back in 1905 to 1911, the turn of the 20th century, during the Constitutional Revolution, which was an epoch-making episode in modern history of Iran because of its political achievements and also because of its enduring social and cultural consequences. For the first time in the history of modern Persia at the time, the revolutionaries sought to replace arbitrary power with law, representative government, and also social justice in order to resist the arbitrary enforcement of power. And this was led by the, you know, this revolution was led by the constitutionalist revolutionaries at the time, who also tried to basically curb the power of conservative religious establishment through modern education and judicial reform. Women were an extremely important part of this movement. They, toward the end of the 19th century and at the beginning of the 20th century, we see that women intellectuals appear in the public scene and start mocking and also contesting the misogyny and hypocrisy of the male intellectuals and also religious clerics of the time. During the 40s and 50s and 60s, we also have women political activists and also educational reformists who play an extremely important role in advocating for women's rights and being part of the women's suffrage movement in Iran. Reforming the marriage laws, reforming the inheritance laws. So I think the reason that is really important for us to understand this moment, that the present moment, as part of that history, is that we, you know, it helps us to avoid this misconception and misunderstanding that this is the first time that the Iranian women have erupted and revolted against the patriarchy. They have been fighting for their rights for over a century. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize the uniqueness of this moment in the sense that in neither of the revolutions, the constitutional revolution of the 20th century, and also the so-called Islamic revolution or the 1979 revolution that happened in 1979, and also the Green Movement that happened in 2009, women's rights never took the center stage. This is the first time that women are at the forefront of this uprising. And I think in that sense, this is a very important moment that in a way connects a woman life freedom revolutionary uprising in Iran to other similar movements around the world that in which women are fighting for reclaiming their bodily authority in Europe, in the United States, and other parts of the world.
Thank you. You're part of a feminist collective which recently published the Iran Women's Bill of Rights, calling for inclusive and substantive equality for women to be enshrined in the Iranian constitution in accordance with the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Could you tell us more about the work of the collective and, you know, your imagining of a better future for Iranian women?
Sure. So, you know, referring to the constitutional revolution of the 1905-1911 and also the 1979 revolution, you know, remembering those moments and reading about them in history, I think made us realize, and by us, I mean, you know, a number of feminists and scholars who initiated this collective back in October, that always women have been excluded from corridors of power and decision making in these critical moments of the past. And the main reason for that has been that they did not really have a concrete plan at hand when, you know, when social uprisings basically happen. They try to find ways to resist the limitations upon them at the individual level and sometimes, you know, semi-institutional levels, but they really never made any effort in the past to concretely document their needs and their demands based on international human rights law and conventions. So this collective, the main aim of this collective has been to basically learn from this history and also remember that although we are, you know, at the sort of at the height of a revolutionary uprising where women are taking the and their needs have taken the center stage, but at the same time we recognize that this could very quickly, you know, be pushed to the margins of the uprising, and if there will be a day that we witness the fall of the Islamic Republic and also the drafting of the new constitution, we wanted to be at a position where we do have a document that is legally bound and also you know, consulted with international human rights law experts to make sure that it follows you know, all the international standards in order to be included in the new constitution of the country in the future. We think that this is an extremely important intervention because it doesn't lead to another moment of marginalization of women and also queer people and people of different gender, sexual, ethnic, religious identities. We also believe that although this is called Women's Bill of Rights, for us Iranian women, you know, a woman's rights basically is a sort of a representation of the rights of all the marginalized bodies from, you know, places that have not been considered at the center of power over the past four decades, as well as I mentioned, queer bodies and people of different ethnic, religious, and gender identities. You know, this collective consists of different generations of feminists, activists, scholars, and we believe that working together from different generations with different experiences of marginalization, discrimination, help us to have a better understanding of, you know, various demands and needs of not only people of the center, but also people of the margins, people who basically belong to different provinces of Iran and different gender, religious identities.
With the feminist collective that you're a part of, how have you found that being part of diaspora activism and having that activism take place in exile, how has that shaped your experiences and the work you do?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think one of the things that, you know, is important to mention is that for a lot of Iranian activists who are actively taking part in creating content or cyber activism or organizing protests in exile, a lot of these people have been active before moving into exile. Like in my own case, I was an active member of Iran's student movement at the time when I was a college student in Tehran University. That was really the beginning of my political activism for the first time. And then, you know, immigrating for for continuing my education also was sort of a new episode in that political activism. Although at the very beginning, I still used to travel back and forth between Iran and the United Kingdom. But following the rise of the Green Movement back in June 2009, I was forced into an involuntary exile, and I was not able to go back. And my activism, my political activism, basically took a new turn. At the beginning, it was really important to be active online. So cyber activism was a very important part of that. Writing a blog was in particular really important at that moment, as well as editing opposition websites. During this new phase of protests in Iran, I think it's probably also a matter of age and experience at this moment. Although I'm also involved in different forms of cyber activism and also, attending in the protests, participating in the protests, organizing them as well. I think at this moment, creating content and also teaching sessions at the university has been really very, very central to this, kind of cultural / political activism in exile. In terms of how exile and diaspora shape the political activism, I would say that one of the things that I think is really remarkable about this phase of movements and protests in Iran is that for the first time really in the history of the Islamic Republic and really in the history of Iranian diaspora, we see an unprecedented, sort of unity among the members of the diaspora. They have found each other thanks to the internet, I would say, has been really important, social media, as well as, different institutions, academic institutions that they're part of, or different collectives and networks of Iranians in diaspora. So really different generations have come together. And I think the reason for this unprecedented unity is really the noble cause of woman life freedom movement, which is about, human dignity. It's about bodily authority of schoolgirls, of college students, of men and women, And I think this has really brought together so many different generations from all walks of life, but also from different political ideologies. There are many people who don't necessarily belong to the same category or to the same history, to the same background. They have come together. And I think that has been really heartening to see that how people can unite over the shared cause. And, and I think the kind of activism that really comes out of this type of unity in diaspora can also take many different shapes. So for example, this time we see that we have an outpouring of creative content from poetry, from illustrations, from paintings, photography, you name it. And I think that is also a form of, producing art is a form of activism. And social media has been really important in as a force and as a platform to distribute and circulate this work, despite, all the limitations that we see with internet, for example, inside the country.
Thank you. I think that takes us very nicely to the next question. In your wonderful book, A Revolution in Rhyme, you look at the attempts of the post-revolutionary Iranian state to use poetry as a tool of political legitimacy and social control, including by co-opting potentially dissident poets. Given that your work was written prior to the current uprising, I think it's very striking that poetic slogans have been so central to both the regime and the protesters. What do you think that poetry can tell us about the ongoing struggle for systemic change in Iran?
So let me start by saying that Iranians are one of the most avid poetry readers, you know, in the world. They love poetry. Poetry is part of their identity. And the reason for that is because of the importance and the centrality of the Persian language over the history. When, you know, Iran as a single Persian-speaking country at some point, and of course, you know, Afghanistan and the Persian world, but with the rise of nationalism and imposing the sort of the national borders following the Second World War, I think Persian language became ever more important as, you know, as sort of a unifying force. And also over the history, you know, during the Mongol invasion, during the Middle Ages and before that. So having said that, I think, you know, it becomes clear why poetry is so intertwined with people's life and their people's identity, to sort of protecting that language as a sort of an identity marker, national identity marker. In the modern period, we see, for example, as I mentioned, during the Constitutional Revolution, we have constitutionalist poets who are also, some of them are political activists, some of them are, you know, singer, musician poets, some of them are parliamentarian poets, politician poets. So you see that poetry really becomes part of that socio-political advocacy of the time. And they play an important role in defining some of the goals of the revolution even at the time. And, you know, they pay a huge cost for it too. Mirzadeh Eshli, constitutionalist poet, was assassinated. He was also a journalist, you know, who had his own newspaper. So he was assassinated as a result of being an outspoken poet. Or Farrukh-i Yazdi, another poet, who was actually murdered in prison during Reza Shah Pahlavi. And then we come to the second Pahlavi era and we see that, again, the same pattern of oppression and persecution of poets who were outspoken. A lot of poets actually were imprisoned following the 1953 coup. During the 60s, during the 70s, we have guerrilla movement poets who, you know, like Khosrow Golsurkhi, who was executed under the second Pahlavi regime. And then we come to 1979 revolution, having poets again as one of the main engines of the 1979 revolution, from all different ideologies really taking part in the revolution. But shortly after that, and following the establishment of the Islamic regime, again, we see a brutal persecution of poets. We have the guerrilla poet Saeed Sultanpour, for example, who was kidnapped from his wedding ceremony and shortly executed after that. And then we have a lot of poets during the 1980s who are pushed into the margins, censored, persecuted, imprisoned, forced into exile. And at the same time, we see that the new government really tries to recruit his own poets and basically recanonize the Persian poetic scene by introducing a new generation of poets who adhered to the ideals of the revolution. So in my book, I really try to, you know, compare this situation in Iran with what happened after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and poets who really, you know, adhered to the ideals of the 1917 revolution in Russia, and then afterwards, some of them were disillusioned, you know, by the revolution. And same thing happened in Iran. At the same time, I think, you know, so at this pattern of resistance versus persecution, so poets kind of, you know, resisting through words and the state responding through force, has been a pattern that we see over the history, coming to this day that, you know, in the past 7 months, poets who were outspoken, who wrote in response to the revolutionary uprising were immediately captured and imprisoned. As we speak, we have dozens of Iranian writers in prison. You know, some of them have received very harsh sentences, unfortunately. And so having that in mind, I think it becomes also clear why, you know, poetry-loving people are also very creative in making their own revolutionary slogans. And I think what really has distinguished this past 7 months in terms of it being a paradigm shift in, you know, in the history of political resistance in Iran and social movements, is the, you know, hearing echoing these social political grievances in the political slogans that people have been chanting in the streets inside the country. And you know, there is a lot to be said about the slogans, but I would like to say a few things. One is about the main slogan of this revolution: woman, life, freedom, Zhan Jian Azadi, or Zan Zendegi Azadi, which originally belonged to the grassroots movement of Kurdish women in Syria, Turkey, and Iran. And I think that, you know, the slogan and its historical and political precedents tell us a lot about why this movement is not about the center, why this movement is about the marginalized bodies first and foremost. And I think we have to be constantly careful about the danger of co-option of this slogan, because the moment that it goes viral, the moment that it becomes universal, all different forms of interpretations and expectations are imposed on it, of course. And, you know, it can take us away from its origins. And I think what really the Kurdish movement is telling us about this, about this slogan, about this movement, is that we should not forget what was the very first demand of this revolutionary uprising. Where was the very first place that this slogan was chanted? It was on the funeral of Jina Amini, or Mahsa Amini, in Saqqez, which is a border city in Kurdistan of Iran. And then very quickly from there, we heard it in Sanandaj, another major Kurdish city. And then it went viral across the country. And it really united people from Sistan and Balochistan in southeast of Iran to people of Kurdistan, people of Ahwaz, people of Khorasan, and people of the center. And then, you know, having woman as also the major keyword in that slogan created a new wave of slogans in which women took the center stage. So if before the murder of Mahsa Amini, we heard, for example, back in 2009, we heard a lot of slogans in which male protesters and their names was being chanted, or during the Iran-Iraq war, or during 1979 revolution. This time, for the first time, we see that female protesters' name become actually the central sort of chanting, you know, cry of the many slogans. Or another important change, so there is a gender factor into it. Another important change, I think, has been the emphasis on the fact that the protest turned into a revolution at some point, which I found really fascinating, because, you know, there is this controversy around, okay, what should we call this? Is this a movement? Is this an uprising? Is this a revolution? And a lot of social scientists and sociologists actually refuse to call it a revolution because of the valid reasons that they discussed, that, you know, we are not in a revolutionary situation because the government hasn't fallen apart yet. And, you know, I don't disagree with that. But I think what is important in the slogans, that the slogans offer us and nothing else, is that affect, that emotional and affective force that you only understand and feel if you are in the streets with the people at the forefront of the protest. And when they said at some point back in October and the beginning of November that بهش نگید اعتراض اسمش شده انقلاب, don't call it a protest, call it a revolution, I think that was a moment when things really began to feel different for those protesters who were at the forefront of the protest inside the country. And of course, there is also, you know, another category of slogans that are, you know, some people have argued that these are basically against the feminist spirit of this revolution, slandering slogans where, I don't know, mothers and sisters' genitals suddenly, you know, take the center stage in the slogans, and when they're cursing basically the authorities, or you know, the sort of the army. And again, I think, you know, that also shows us that we do have a very long way to realize those, you know, goals, the sort of the gender equality. You know, there are deep layers of misogyny and patriarchy that needs to change. On the linguistic level, I think slogans tell us what exists in the culture and in, you know, in the sort of the collective psyche that needs to be addressed. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't forget that a lot of these slandering slogans, which is not, by the way, limited only to Iran. For example, we heard it in Egypt too, in, you know, the so-called Arab Spring slogans. I think it really shows the level of frustration and the level of anger and rage that, you know, comes out sometimes in the form of sort of misogynist and slandering slogans.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. That was a fantastic overview. I also really wanted to discuss your own poetic work. How does your poetry inform your activism and vice versa?
You know, being a woman, growing up as a woman in a relatively conservative, you know, context and also city, what it meant to me was that since very, very young age, I would say maybe 9 or 10, I really, now that I look back, I feel like I became an activist as soon as I got to know myself as a woman, because I had to resist, you know, a lot of patriarchal treatment and behavior in, you know, the social setting in which I was part of from a very young age. And that really required an activist spirit, because you had to be actively involved and engaged with what was happening around you, and then actively resist and defy it as well. So I wrote poetry since I was maybe 14 or 15, but very soon, around maybe 16 or 17 year old, I noticed that, you know, I'm writing about forbidden love. I'm writing about dancing, which was, you know, forbidden in public, or sort of erotic take on, you know, the human relationship was something that I was really into when I was still a teenager and sort of coming of age. But then once I started to writing actively as a blogger and sharing my poetry online, I think I realized also that, you know, I'm under the gaze of this state control that I had to be careful about, because there was only so much that I could write about and not be censored. So there were a lot of poems at the time that I was not publishing, for example. I also considered that as an act of activism, if you like, you know. And then during the college years, I think my poetry took a more political turn in terms of the themes that I was writing about. And then really, I would say it was really during like maybe 24, 5 years old when the Green Movement happened, that I was deeply inspired by the defiance and resistance of the people, but at the same time, the oppression and the brutal, you know, persecution of the political prisoners, and concepts of sort of themes of loss and displacement and exile, which was a very new phase and very new experience in my life. I was a PhD student at Oxford at the time, and I was still thinking that I will be able to go back and forth. It took me really a couple of years in order to come to terms with my new state of existence, meaning not being able to go back home. And poetry for me became that sort of shelter, that refuge, and at the same time, the space where I could speak about experiences that I could not otherwise discuss. So poetry has been a form of activism for me in a way, but at the same time has been informed by, you know, my aspirations and my work. And I would say that my activism is also informed by my poetry, in the sense that they really are constantly in interaction and relationship with one another. You know, I'm concerned and interested in political resistance, in notions of ideology, in the relationship of the poet with the society, also poet with the power. And I think poetry itself always offered, you know, sort of offered me that safe space to be who I wanted to be.
What do you see as the future of the current uprising? And for anyone listening today, is there a message that you'd like to leave them with?
You know, I'm very hopeful about the future of this current uprising. The reason I'm hopeful is because I think not only the Iranians, but also the world really had seen unprecedented scenes of bravery, courage, and defiance by the youngest generation of Iranians. And I think for the first time, for those of us who live outside Iran, in a place like the United States, for example, that has this hostile relationship with Iran for the past, you know, four decades because of terrible things that happened between the two countries. For the first time, I witnessed in my everyday life, in my interaction with ordinary Americans, that they're separating the Iranian society from the Iranian government. And they don't have this sort of homogenous view of the society, Iranians, every single Iranian being a terrorist, or every single Iranian being, you know, anti-human rights, or you know, that kind of misconception that unfortunately the American common sense had suffered from for the longest period of time because of the sort of the propaganda and because of the media, mainstream media. I think for the first time, we see that the world has recognized that there is a huge gap between the Iranian people and their government, that they also don't want this government, and they are also trying to get rid of the government that, you know, has imposed force and arbitrary force on them for so many decades. Why this is important? Because I think, first of all, the imagination and conception of the world about Iranians have changed, and that in itself is a revolutionary act. That we owe it to the Iranian girls and women and men who really put their lives on the line in order to, you know, to break these stereotypical notions of perceiving people in Iran, sort of in the international level. I'm also hopeful because I think even the Iranian people themselves did not imagine the scenes that we saw in the past 7 months in the streets of Iran, you know, girls going on top of the cars, burning their veils, making bonfires with their mandatory hijab. For me, as a literary scholar, that is just a metaphor of the dead corpse of a rotted ideology that is no longer functional. Yes, the government responded with force, responded with rape, with persecution, with imprisonment and sexual assault. But I think the time has come for the world, and this is my message to your listeners, the time has come for the world to really start imagining an Iran without the Islamic Republic. I would say my main concern right now is that the international community, like Iranian people, are ready to get rid of their government. But I don't think the international community is. And unfortunately, there is a lot for them at stake to lose. You know, years and years of taking advantage of the Iran's natural resources at a very low cost because of the sanctions, because of the hostility with the government, and for the on the side of the Iranian government for the fact that they have been basically fighting for survival. So they haven't really minded, you know, basically giving the country away for a very, very cheap price. And, you know, at some point, the world needs to also make some sacrifices in order for the Iranian people to, you know, to be able to have a democratic country. The Iranian society is way more advanced than this government, but they cannot get rid of this government only on the by themselves. They also need the international community to support them. So my message to those who are listening to your podcast is to keep amplifying the voice of the Iranian people. If you don't see it in the mainstream media outlets, if they don't make the headlines, it doesn't mean that this movement is dead. It's not over. It's just under the skin of the society, like an active volcano that is waiting for another moment to erupt.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shams. That was incredibly powerful, especially the visceral images that your speech provoked in me. It was incredibly beautiful. So thank you for
thank
that.
You.
And thank you for spending time with us and talking to us and our listeners. It has been an honor to have you. For those who are listening, we hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you do have any questions or comments, please find us on Twitter via @declarationspod or like us on Facebook. You can also send us an email at editor@declarationspod.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on today's episodes. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in more for our next episode on declarations. Thank you.